Mesdames et messieurs, bonsoir et bienvenue à la Grande Bibliothèque. Je me présente, Lucie Laberge, représentante de Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec. Bibliothèque et Archives nationales du Québec et l'Institut Thomas More sont heureux de présenter ce soir la première d'une série de 4 entrevues intitulée « The Culture of Our Cities, Conversations on Today's Urban Experience », au cours desquelles des invités de marque partagent avec le public leur point de vue sur la complexité grandissante de nos villes en expansion. L'invité de ce soir est M. Julian Scher, réalisateur pendant 10 ans de l'émission The Fifth Estate et auteur. M. Scher est également conseiller auprès des médias, auteur et journaliste. Il a créé le portail journalismnet.com et en est toujours le webmestre. Il sera interviewé par Mme Pauline Beauchamp et M. Alex Farrell de l'Institut Thomas More. Je voudrais maintenant présenter notre partenaire. Fondé à Montréal il y a 62 ans, l'Institut Thomas More offre aux étudiants adultes un programme d'études menant à l'obtention d'un diplôme universitaire en sciences humaines dans une démarche participative où les débats encadrés par des animateurs expérimentés remplacent les cours proprement dits. Chaque printemps, depuis 13 ans, l'Institut Thomas More organise une série d'entrevues sur les grands enjeux culturels et moraux de notre temps. La prochaine entrevue de la série « The Culture of Our Cities » de l'Institut Thomas More aura lieu le 15 mai. Madame Sherry Simon, professeure titulaire au département d'études françaises de l'Université Concordia, sera l'invitée de l'Institut. L'entrevue de ce soir est enregistrée et vous pourrez la réentendre en balado-diffusion sur notre site Internet. Cette entrevue, qui se déroule en anglais, sera suivie d'une période de questions. Sans plus tarder, je cède la parole à nos invités et je vous souhaite une bonne soirée.
Merci infiniment, Lucie. Good evening and welcome to this, our Thomas More Spring Interview Series for 2007. My name is Jim Cullen, and I'm the president of the Thomas More Institute. Before I introduce our panel, I want to say a few words about the Institute. We provide courses, as was just mentioned, en français for the last 62 years. 500 students have been with us during each of those past couple of years and each of the last many years. Many take these courses, and most take these courses, because they want to satisfy their curiosity. At Thomas More Convocation on June 12th, we'll honor those students who have completed their Bachelor of Arts degree because of our affiliation with Bishop's University. And Linda Leith will be our guest at that convocation. All the students at Thomas More benefit from courses grounded in our discussion method. And copies of our prospectus from last year, 2006-2007, are available at the entrance, and work is well underway for our prospectus for 2007-08. And we'll be offering some special events because of the celebration we'll be having around the 100th anniversary of the birth of Eric O'Connor, one of the founders of Thomas More. This year, as you just heard, the Grande Bibliothèque, the Bibliothèque et Archives Nationales de Québec, has honored us by inviting us to this wonderful auditorium in the Grande Bibliothèque. We would like to congratulate Lise Bissonnette and her team. The Grande Bibliothèque celebrated its second anniversary just last week, and how timely a celebration. The library received a prestigious award from the AIA-ALA Library Building Awards in 2007. So thank you to the Grande Bibliothèque for its hospitality. This is the first of 4 interviews taking place around the theme, The Culture of Our Cities, Conversations on Today's Urban Experience. We dedicate this series of interviews to Ben Scher. Mr. Scher died this past year. Ben and Olga Scher have been companions of the Thomas More Institute for many years. Ben Scher was a friend, an artist, a humanitarian and a cherished colleague, whose questioning spirit was an inspiration to all who knew him. Our guest this evening is Julian Scher, renowned investigative journalist, documentary producer, and media consultant. Mr. Scher is the creator and webmaster of journalismnet.com. He has trained journalists around the world to master the internet as a tool for investigative reporting. Julian Scher directed an award-winning documentary that recently won the Alfred I. DuPont Columbia University Silver Baton for excellence in broadcast journalism. The documentary was entitled Nuclear Jihad: Can Terrorists Get the Bomb? His recent books, some of which you'll find outside at our table at the entrance, One Child at a Time, The Global Fight to Rescue Children from Online Predators, and another book with William Marsden, The Road to Hell, How the Biker Gangs Are Conquering Canada. He is a graduate of McGill University in Honors History. We've invited Alex Farrell and Pauline Beauchamp to interview Mr. Scher this evening. Both are discussion leaders at Thomas More Institute. Alex has been a discussion leader for the last 10 years at TMI. He's a retired editor-in-chief of Reader's Digest in Canada and in Germany. And before his quarter century at the Reader's Digest, Alex was an editorial writer and op-ed editor at the Montreal Gazette. Prior to that, he was a correspondent for the Canadian Press and in various bureaus in Canada and abroad. He has been a lifelong journalist. He's a graduate in arts and major in history from Concordia University. Pauline Beauchamp graduated from McGill and was awarded two fellowships in theater. She has been passionately interested in literature, history, and ideas, as well as in exploring the connections between different disciplines. She has a strong interest in environmental and social issues, social justice issues, and has volunteered with organizations such as 10,000 Villages, the Fair Trade Network of Stores. She has worked with Air Liquide Canada since 1993 and is involved in design and content of websites and a variety of other projects. She has recently completed a book on historical biography, exploring the relationship between the lives of writers and artists and their fictional creations in 17th century England and 18th century France. This book is presently touring the publishers looking for a home. Alex and Pauline will complete their discussion with Mr. Scher over the next hour, and then I will call upon you, our audience, to ask some questions of Mr. Scher. So now to our panel.
Thank you, Jim. Good evening, everyone. We're beginning our discussion of the urban experience by looking at some somber problems about which most of us probably know very little. In a small town or village, people learn at first hand just about everything that they need to know or want to know about what's going on around them. And the urban experience, as we all know, is quite different. So I'd like to begin by asking you, Julian, what part or parts does the journalist properly play in the urban experience?
Well, I think the role of a journalist, certainly the way I see the role of a journalist, is to be the sort of bothersome person who turns over the rocks and finds the dark spaces and the worms and the spiders that people don't want to see. And more importantly, shine a light in the dark corners that often the powerful, and the powerful could be the people in power, it could be the politicians, the corporations, the union leaders, or it could be the powerful crime lords, shine a light in the dark corners of society that people don't want to be exposed. I often liken it, my role, as an investigative journalist, which is a special brand of journalism, that only a few of us have the time and dedication to do. But I liken the kind of investigative journalism I do to holding a dark mirror to society. When Jim and the Thomas More first invited me, and I was greatly appreciative, especially because it's dedicated to my father, I sort of figured discussion on the urban landscape, and I've done books on, my latest book is on child predators, books on the biker gangs, books on wrongful convictions, corrupt cops. I figured, whoa, I'm not sure this is quite your travelogue. But I would argue that my job is to hold a dark mirror to society. It's a mirror. This is the real reflection of our city. It's not the city that most of you know, but it's only because you are only superficially living in the city. I was walking out of the Y this morning. I love to see, you know, the joke is always Montreal only has two seasons, winter and construction. But I was walking out, and the Stanley Street was completely ripped off. And, you know, we think of our streets as normal, but if you ever see, I'm fascinated when you see inside all the water pipes and the tubings, there's a whole underworld that lies underneath our city. Well, I would argue that there's a whole underworld of crime that controls our city, and there's a whole underworld now in the internet. Most of you here, even though most of you have the same hair color that I have, are active on the internet one way or the other. Your children are, your grandchildren are. And there is this whole world going on behind that you don't know about. So to sum up, I think the job of a journalist is to expose that world, to speak truth to power, to force governments, schools, those that have families, people who have some say, to face the problems they would normally prefer to ignore.
You talk about that underworld that exists in both the real world that we see all around us and also on the internet, which most of us are probably very unaware of. Could you speak a little bit about how the internet is changing our concept of a city itself or of a neighborhood?
That's an excellent question because, you know, I grew up in the Snowden district of Montreal, right? I knew all the parks. I knew our neighbors. Obviously, I knew my school. I knew the schools that were where my friends went. I knew the shopping centers. That was my neighborhood. We traveled regularly up north, so I knew the Laurentians. And then we would occasionally travel beyond, but it was a very small, restricted neighborhood. And then television gave me at the time. I grew up in the 60s, 50s and 60s, so television, it was mainly Westerns and a couple of police dramas, gave me a bit of a peek into the American world. Well, my son is here, he's 23, my daughter is 21, and my nieces are, about 11 and 13. Their world is completely different, right? They have access on the internet to vast communities. Let me give you just one example. 61%, these are American statistics, but in fact there's every reason to believe that if anything we're actually higher, given Canada is somewhat wealthier and more plugged in. 61% of teenagers have a personal profile. For those of you who don't know the difference between Yahoo and YouTube, personal profiles are so you've probably heard of MySpace. These are social networking pages where kids can post their own kind of pictures and their favorites. This is where your children and your children are hanging out. It is more important for the younger children, especially today. I was speaking to some police officers and top prosecutors yesterday, leading prosecutors in the United States and Canada at a major conference, right? And they were all, warning about some of the dangers, but all their kids have MySpace profiles, right? This is the neighborhood that children live in. But it's also the neighborhood that most of you live in now, because you have computers, you're being affected by viruses and other things like that, but you're also being affected by predators and by the child pornography that exists on the internet. So to sort of, end on the danger of the virtual neighborhood, it's a glorious neighborhood. It's my father, who, when he passed away, was 84, was constantly on the internet, emailing. It was his lifeline because he was in a wheelchair. It was his new, it was his attachment to Thomas More. It was a way he would come to sessions at the Thomas More with new printouts and documents. But that same internet has become the world's playground, and it is a very dangerous, scary playground.
Yes, but you still wonder why particular people do what they do. Is there something about urban life that makes young people more insecure, more vulnerable?
The other day at this conference, one of the police officers, when he was interviewing, I've met a few predators and pedophiles behind prison bars, but one of the things they told this officer, which is very true, is he said, "I can spot a child who needs love a mile away." Right. And they could spot it either in the real world where they see this child, or they could spot it in the online chat rooms. Mm-hmm. So I think it is true. I think children, in part because their neighborhoods, again, I think it's a bit of a myth where we all wax eloquently about how wonderful it was when we were children and now it's so different. But it is true. My mother would drop us off. She would go to Steinberg's. Even using the name shows how old things have changed, right? But we'd stop at the Steinberg shopping store and park me outside in the stroller, and there'd be like six strollers lined up, right? And go inside for shopping. You'd be arrested for child neglect if you did that today, right? So it is a bit of a changed world. But also, children now live in suburbs or cities. They don't play that often on the streets. You were commenting, I think you said, when we met at lunch, about how often the playground seemed empty during the day. You know, so children are having fun. It's appointment fun, right? They're off to the soccer game, and then they have their private ballet class, and then they have, you know, they're watching their favorite TV show. So they are turning to the internet.
Well, most children are naturally curious, and they have a spirit of adventure, don't they? And they're bringing these qualities to this playground.
And they should. You know, the police who are now trying to grapple with this, especially in the UK where they're a bit path-breaking, they don't want to shut down the internet because it's the most wonderful communication tool, both for the police but also for children. I mean, it's amazing what children can discover, and it overall is extremely positive. But the example I give is, hopefully we'll wrap this up, say, around 9 o'clock tonight, right? And you'll go home and it'll be 9:30. Let's say some of you have a 9-year-old child or you're babysitting for your grandchild, and your 9-year-old child at 9:30 has got about a half an hour left before bedtime and says, "Can I go to the park tonight to play?" And you'd say, "No, it's 9:30, it's dark outside." And they say, "Well, while you're watching, you know, House tonight on TV or something, can I go downstairs to the basement and play on the internet?" And you say, "Yes, perfect, go downstairs," right? Unsupervised, in an unpublic part of the house, you have no idea where your child is going. Your child, if he goes to the playground, first, has probably been street-proofed, so he knows not to take candy from a stranger. Even if he gets into trouble, he knows the neighbors, he knows where to go home, and he probably knows where the local police station is. Your child on the internet is unaware of the dangers on the internet, has not been street-proofed by you, because you don't know how to street-proof your child, and has no idea where to go for help. He can shut down the computer, but if he gets lured into trouble or stumbles across things, in most cases, he's going to be unaware, as you are. And you're not even aware of the danger because you've sent him down to the new babysitter, which is the internet.
So what are some of the things that we are trying to do to better police that neighborhood?
Well, it's... I try to tell a lot of fascinating stories in the book because it is the new face of crime in the 21st century, and it is real life CSI. The good thing about crime on the internet is the bad guys always have to leave digital footprints. They're often hidden and they're encrypted and they're hard to find and it's extremely anonymous. But as somebody we were saying yesterday, you know, imagine a crime where they commit the crime, they take pictures of the crime, they put those pictures on the internet, and they exchange and broadcast the crime that they made. So that's kind of good news for the police. The bad news is the latest numbers at the National Center in the United States, which collects all these images, is that there are 7.5 million pictures currently circulating. Many of them are copies of the same picture and certainly copies of the same children. So the police are drowning, absolutely drowning in evidence. Unlike real-life CSI, where they're desperate for the smallest fingernail and hair sample at a murder scene, the police have too much data. So they began to realize that this was a new kind of crime, and they've trying several things. One of the most ingenious, some of you have probably heard the story, and it takes up a big part of the book, is a Toronto cop did what we all love to do and all dream of doing, was so frustrated by everything going on the internet, he said, "I'm going to write an angry email to the one person I hold responsible," and he wrote an email to Bill Gates. And he said, "This is your problem, fix it." And he actually said, "I'm frustrated and I need help." He pressed send and walked away and promptly forgot about it. But Bill Gates didn't. Bill Gates read the email, answered the email, and told Microsoft Canada to meet with the police. And, you know, as you read in the book, the Microsoft people came, and I talked to them, and they were sort of expecting, like us, the police would be kind of like CSI, you know, not only handsome and sleek, but their offices would all be blue-lit and just the latest technology. And as I sort of say, they were expecting CSI, they got Kojak, right? Because Most cops are, two-finger typers, and they had just been using typewriters a few years ago. So the Microsoft people realized that there was a problem. But the police realized the Microsoft people, like most of you here, also had a problem, because you have no idea. When we think child pornography, what do you think of? You think of Lolita, maybe, girls who are 14, 15, 16, who could maybe pass for 18, somewhat naughty pictures. And I promise you, both in the book and in my, in our talk tonight, I won't horrify you with descriptions, but I will horrify you with statistics. 40% of the pictures that these police are looking at, and this is what shocked Microsoft, are children under 5. 19% are children under 3. Right. So they showed just a couple of these pictures to the Microsoft people, and the Microsoft people said, "What can we do to help?" So what they came up with. Is basically a Google for cops, although Microsoft would never use that word. It's a database that searches all the police information. And as a result of this database that Microsoft has built, they've been able to rescue at least 40 children and put more than 60 predators behind bars. So that's just one little example of one little email that kind of changed policing.
I think it's very difficult for most of us to understand why people do this. It's much easier to understand the motivations of the drug lords and biker gangs. I mean, they, after all, are essentially businessmen without any scruples, aren't they?
Yeah.
That's what they are.
Wouldn't
you agree?
Although I'm not sure that's necessarily different than the other businessmen who don't have scruples. No, but you're right.
But to what extent have these biker gangs actually inserted themselves into our business life, and how deep and broad is the penetration?
It's surprising. Crime experts will say that if you look at the history of crime, you sort of crime families, crime groups, whether it was. Jewish and Irish immigrants who came especially in the turn of the century, in 1920s in New York and here in Montreal in 1930s, the Italian generations that came, and then later with the bikers. If you look at what the progress is of crime groups, it's usually a somewhat disenfranchised group that comes in, often immigrants, right? Not always. We'll talk about that in a minute, because bikers, that's what's so unique about bikers, is they're indigenous. But it's an ostracized group that some members find the only way they can get ahead is get involved in crime. They start off as kind of street thugs, bouncers. Dutch Schultz in the 20s, and then the Al Capones. And then what happens is you then move up, you become a crime lord, and you control a big part of the business. And then the final stage is legitimacy. We saw it with Mr. Rizzuto, right, who was just convicted last week and pleaded guilty. But even though everybody knows he was leader of the mafia, he's a successful businessman, he has businesses, and he's quote, quite legit. Well, the bikers have gone through those same stages. Most are still kind of losers who ride around on Harleys and commit petty crime. But out in Vancouver, even here, Maurice Malmbouche had a huge spread of a farm out in Contrecoeur, lived very well, far away from his roots, just down, I'm not sure where we're situated, but just down this way, I suspect, in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve. He was a poor boy from there, and he grows up to be then come quite rich and established as an organized crime leader. In British Columbia, where the bikers were around the longest for about 20 years and are now the wealthiest, those of you who are familiar with Vancouver, if you're in the East End, if you could go down Hastings Street, you could buy a nice pair of designer jeans, go across the street and sip a nice coffee at a cafe, buy a cell phone, and then go shopping at one of the main shopping stores on Davie, and all those stores that you've visited are run and owned by Hells Angels. Mm. So they've moved into a whole other level of business. I was down in Florida interviewing a man who was about to be sentenced for 17 years. He was a very prominent lawyer. He was a money launderer for the Hells Angels. The Hells Angels were active in laundering hundreds of thousands of dollars through the stock market.
How have they managed then to be this successful? Is it the fault of law enforcement, or Complacency on our parts?
Yes, to both of those. I mean, organized crime will always be there. The bikers benefited from a fairly strong organization. The bikers could teach Al-Qaeda a lot of lessons of cellular structure. The Hells Angels are structured. The Hells Angels don't have a John Gotti. Putting Maurice Mambouche away for two life sentences is bad for Mambouche, but doesn't have much impact on the Hells Angels, because unlike the Mafia, which is a pyramid, and if you knock off Mr. Rizzuto, it's going to have an impact, and they'll have to pick a new leader. The Hells Angels, all the chapters work quite independently, and even within a chapter, all the members are quite independent. So it's quite a brilliant structure, because in Quebec, we put over 100 bikers away when police had the big crackdown in 2001 and eliminated about four chapters in Quebec. But that still left the Trois-Rivières, the Sorel, the Quebec City chapter, and their bikers are actually, there are more Hells Angels now than there were five, 6 years ago. There's about 120 in Quebec. There's only about 500 in all of Canada. But Canada has one out of five bike Hells Angels of around the world. So they have a very intense cellular independent structure. Police come in, try to smash a group, the rest of the group can function. They're a very powerful group because it's harder to join the Hells Angels than it is the police or the army. It's a very elite group. It takes 2-3 years of screening before they'll let you in. Very hard for the police to infiltrate unless they use undercover agents. And, as you pointed out, for the longest time, we, as a society, said, well, they're kind of bikers, they're a bit losers, they're kind of greasers. Or there was an element of respect, less so here in Canada, but certainly in the United States and my travels in California. The bikers are the epitome of the American outlaw, right? The Harley has replaced the horse, the Billy the Kid, you know, the Jesse James, the freedom to ride. And it's attractive to a lot of people. And rightly so, everybody should have the freedom to sort of have fun and do whatever you want on the weekend. You don't have the freedom to sell drugs to children and rape and murder people. So the bikers benefited from our underestimation of them and from this folkloric kind of easy rider mythology around them. So much so that the police ignored them consistently, didn't set up special biker squads. And I'm glad to say that it took our first book, Road to Hell, to shock certainly the police in the West Coast, as we were talking about this before. You know, a journalist's job is to speak truth to power. So when we did our first book, Road to Hell, we exposed tremendous examples of police wrongdoing, especially in BC and especially by the RCMP. Huge drug busts that got turned into a disaster because of police incompetence. The Hells Angels who were able to run roughshod. After the book comes out, the RCMP immediately launched an investigation into me. And I saw the piece of paper because they rightly assumed that I had good sources within the RCMP and the police, and the police sources who gave me the sources, I was out going out for drinks with them, and they said, here, Jillian, you should look at this. And it was, you know, investigation into the Road to Hell, and they wanted to know who were the officers who had spoken to me. So they didn't want to know. You know, they didn't want to launch an investigation into the Hells Angels, and they didn't want to launch an investigation into themselves in terms of how they screwed up. They wanted to launch an investigation into me. The good news is that, to the RCMP's credit, cooler heads prevailed. And as I recount, as we recounted in the second book, new people moved into the RCMP, some people who were already there, and took the lessons to heart, not just from me, but from their own members, who I quoted, and they reorganized. And as a result of that, the Hells Angels, who were extremely cocky out west and laughing at what had happened in Quebec, now find themselves on the run. More than 20 have been arrested in major undercover work, which we document in our second book. So sometimes, I must say extremely rarely, speaking truth to power does work, and you could actually affect change.
But am I right in concluding from your book that the police would get almost nowhere if it weren't for undercover agents, and even more for informants, for people who, for one reason or another, betray their other people in the bicycle gangs?
Absolutely. People get quite out. There's a couple of cases that are still going on. The case I just mentioned in British Columbia, the informant was paid $1 million. In the pre-trials that are going on now, he's being put on trial because he's a drug user. The police sold drugs on the street, not controlled drugs. These are drugs that they knew were going out there and ending up in some kid's veins or something like that. He beat people up. Danny Kane, the most heralded informant inside the Quebec Hells Angels, who helped take down Mont Boucher, eventually committed suicide, murdered three people while he was on contract by the police. They didn't know that. And when they found that out, they fired him. This was the RCMP. The RCMP were running Danny Kane as an informant, and he was doing great work for them. What they didn't know is he also was getting paid to murder enemies of the Hells Angels. Well, when it blew up in their faces, the RCMP walked away. But the Montreal police had the wisdom to sort of say, well, he'd be a great informant now because the Hells Angels will really trust a guy who has murdered three people. So they put him back on contract, controlled him now with a leash. He didn't do anything illegal while he was working for the Montreal police, and he infiltrated the Hells Angels. People, you know, tend to turn up their noses and saying, why are the police working with these scumbags? Well, because the nuns and choir boys are not going to get very far infiltrating the Hells Angels. The only way you can catch the Hells Angels is by using informants. So in the books, we sort of describe the rather messy role and sometimes the errors the police make. In the United States, they actually use police officers who go undercover. You know, we tell the story of the police officers. Now, it's interesting when you go to the internet, because what I found with the In One Child at a Time, when I was meeting the undercover cops, there are undercover cops. Now, it's an example of how the internet has changed things. In the biker world, they know me, the bikers know me, and they won't necessarily trust me, but I think there's a certain amount of respect. And they know all the biker cops. They're not going to let somebody in their organization who hasn't been around for 2, 3, sometimes 5 or 6 years. So it's extremely hard to infiltrate. On the internet, a 35-year-old man will be surfing the internet and trying to lure a 13-year-old girl. He will pretend, often initially, to be a 15-year-old or 17-year-old or maybe even her age to try to lure her. That's the beauty of the internet from a criminal's point of view, because he is anonymous. Well, of course, what he doesn't know is that the 13-year-old could also be an undercover cop who's actually 33 years old. And in the book, I tell the story of Emily. Emily is an undercover FBI agent. She's 33, and she pretends to be a 13-year-old. And as she says, I never thought catching predators online was rocket science until I caught a rocket scientist. She goes online as a 13-year-old. She works at the time. She worked out of the FBI's main headquarters called Innocent Images, and she logs on, and like within minutes. She gets hit upon by these men in these chat groups, and they're not allowed to entrap them, so she's saying, oh, mom and dad are away, and do you like lacrosse, because her code name had something to do with lacrosse, and the men said, yeah, I said, you must be cool, you must be a cheerleader, are you sexy? Usually within minutes they start sending pictures to her of their body parts. And this man wanted to meet her at the mall, and she kept stalling and stalling because they have to get it, right? So she says, are you sure? I mean, isn't this illegal? We shouldn't be doing this. He says, no, no. At one point, there's a great scene in the book where he says, are you a police agent? She goes, no. And then you see the transcript, and he says, well, you know, because there are a lot of police agents. She says, the CIA doesn't hire 9-year or 13-year-olds with, like, exclamation points, right? So he goes to the mall expecting to meet her, and he gets arrested and sent away for 6 years. So the beauty of the internet is that the police can do in a much easier way what biker cops have to spend years doing. And, of course, there's no risk to the police doing undercover work. I kind of like that change, how in the dangerous netherworld of the internet, everybody could be a dog, as they say, you know, in the Saturday, in the Harper's cartoon.
There is another element that you talk about in One Child at a Time. We've talked about the power base for the bikers going after power and going after money. But there's also a money element with the predator, not necessarily the pedophiles themselves, but there are people who are making a lot of money off that. Yeah. Is that a completely different kind of investigation that's required?
It is, and it's a good point. I mean, most of the online child abuse images, we can talk later in question period why the word child pornography is actually not accurate, but most of the child exploitation material has the value that rare hockey cards have, right? People trade, you know, everybody wants the Mickey Mantle card or a valuable hockey player card. It's the same thing. These images are valued. Everybody wants the complete series, so they have value, but there's no money exchange. It's just people exchanging pictures of horribly abused children. But crime, like nature, abhors a vacuum. And crime elements, especially organized crime elements, quickly moved in. People who have no pedophilic tendencies, have no interest in abusing children, but realized you could make a fast buck. Think about it. You know, to bring in, bless their hearts, the Hell's Angels, I mean, to bring in mountains and mountains and tons of cocaine is a fairly complicated deal. It's why a lot of the bikers have moved over to meth, creating crystal meth, because you can kind of cook it in the bathtub. You tend to blow up houses and you know, ruin your drains, but it's fairly easy. Bringing in huge amount of cocaine, which you can only get largely from Latin America, or in Montreal's case, bringing in heroin from South Asia, is extremely expensive. You've got to, you know, ship the boats. You have to know which boats. You have to have your all your dock workers. Thankfully, in Montreal, you control the ports, as you do in Vancouver, so that sort of helps. Mm-hmm. But it's still difficult. And then if you get caught, you get sent away for a lot of years. Well, criminals said, wait a minute. We can take all these pictures or steal all these pictures, send them for absolutely no cost, millions of pictures at a time, over encrypted email, set up a bunch of dummy servers so they'll never be able to find us. And even if they do find us, we'll get sent away for maybe like 1 or 2 years, and we'll make millions. So a Texas couple, completely, I don't want to say not, I mean, they had no interest in sexually abusing children. They were called the Reedies. They were living out of a trailer at one point. By the time they ended, they had I think they had 2 Mercedes. They were making millions of dollars in something called Landslide. They offered a website, adult porn and child porn, and you kind of clicked. It was credit card. This is the only contraband. You know, the Medellin cartel does not accept Visa and MasterCard. But child porn sites do. Visa was so embarrassed, and it's exact, you know, not a bank. Visa and most of the other banks were asleep at the switch for the longest time. They didn't, you know, money was being made. They don't really have to know what, you know, Acme Inc. is actually selling. Mm. When Visa actually started investigating, they were appalled at the amount of sites that had their logo. And so they're now spidering the web, they call it. They're going out and searching the web for companies that use. The police began to crack down, and in one case, the Visa approached 3 Russian banks, tightly connected to... a lot of banks in Russia are tightly connected to organized crime, and organized crime is very powerful in Russia. When I was in Moscow, what struck me is that it looks like New York, but it functions like Uganda, and that's what Moscow was like. Visa approached 3 banks and said, you have clients who are using our card through your account selling child porn, and the bank said so, and they refused to take down the sites until Visa threatened and actually fined them, and then the banks eventually did it. So yes, it's a whole other level of investigation that police are only now getting into.
What does it take to arouse the public? In your book, The Road to Hell, you relate a number of murders, a shocking number of murders, but I think we recall all of them getting some media attention at the time they were committed. But it was only when a child was murdered in the mid-90s,
Danny DeRochelle,
that there was overwhelming public pressure brought on the government to do something.
And I think I think that's exactly what it takes. There were I think the total is about 162 deaths. I may be off by a couple. In Montreal, I mean, most of us lived through that. 162 deaths. I mean, it's nothing. That's a bad day in Baghdad. But you know, in the worst times of the Capone years in Chicago, which is held up as the epitome of organized crime, I think in the entire Chicago gang wars, there were like 30 deaths. Yeah. We had 160 in the space of a few years. There were 182 arson attacks, not to mention all the attempted murders. And largely we didn't care because it was felt it was garbage removal, right? The bad guys were killing and shooting each other. And that was the police attitude as well, until... really very close to here, about 20 or 30 blocks from here, Danny Desrochers was out playing an 11-year-old, and the bikers were getting rid of fellow garbage, and they didn't care. They blew up a Jeep, and a piece of shrapnel went into Danny's head. Shortly after, so public were outraged, and that began to turn things around. Shortly after, one of our colleagues, Michel Auger, was gunned down. 7 bullets were fired. 6 went into his body. The only reason he survived is the assassin who was trying to... For those of you who don't know, Michel was Montreal's famous and best crime reporter working for Journal de Montréal, and the assassin hid the gun in the umbrella, and the umbrella tip tended to push the bullets down, so even though he was aiming for his head, He ended up having 6 bullets from his shoulder to his waist. Michel survived. He's doing quite well, thank you. But that death, that attempted assassination, outraged the public. And there was a story of a waitress who was shot, used as a human shield. So it took something like that to outrage people. And it does take often a singular moment to get people upset. It's the same in many cases with child predators. It's the case of one missing girl, right? That sort of captivates an audience. I think that's just the way we are. We need a story, a myth to grab onto.
At what point does this online activity become criminal? I mean, you can have a lot of it going on without the child ever being drawn out of the home. And, you know, there's a certain amount of conversation going on that may be ambiguous. At what point does the activity become criminal?
There's several levels of criminality. It is absolutely illegal in Canada and most other Western countries to view and download child pornography. Child pornography is usually defined as illicit, explicit images of a child. A child in Canada is defined as under 18. Although it's rare, people will be charged for anything but prepubescent pictures. But if you're looking at sexually explicit pictures of children in sexual situations where their sexual organs are exposed and whatnot, it is illegal to download it, even under the guise of research, scientific study, or whatever. If people say, oh, I downloaded it accidentally and it was a pop-up, the police are not going to charge you. Where they will charge you, I'm just giving people warnings here if anybody is, where they will charge you if they notice that file, if you say, oh, I accidentally, it just came up, I had no idea what I was doing, it could happen. But if you rename that file, you move that file into another folder, neat pictures, you know, you open, and police can find this out on your computer, you reopen that picture a dozen times in the last week, that's not an accident. So any of that is illegal. Just to give you a hint, though, in Arizona, one picture, 10 years prison. In Canada, you could have hundreds of pictures. Up until recently, you would get usually a conditional sentence, which means no jail time. Just now, we've imposed minimum penalty of 14 days for possession of picture. So for possession of picture, it's immediately a crime. For distribution, if you distribute it, it's a somewhat more serious crime. If you make the picture, it's an even more serious crime, because obviously if you've made the picture, you have direct access to the children. We can get in maybe into question period about why it isn't just pictures, because a huge percentage of those who are distributing the pictures have hands-on abuse records and have access to the children. The second level of crime, so that's the pictures, is luring. We call it luring here in Canada. They're called traveling offenses in the United States. Engaging in a child, using the internet to communicate with a child in order to try to have sexual relations. The lurers usually immediately commit an offense because they send pornography right away over the internet to the child in order to seduce them or to get them ready. That's already an offense. But if they're just chatting and saying, trying to be friendly, if it stops there, and a lot of times it does, that's not a crime. They'll usually try to track the person down because they figure the guy's usually up to something else. But the minute they try to arrange to him for a meeting, and then actually show up, that's a crime. It's a luring offense, and under Canada, you'll get about 2 to 3 years, depending.
We're discussing these problems in the context of the urban experience, but, you know, you have a very dramatic opening in the book, The Road to Hell. There's an eerie silence surrounding a house one morning. After a while, a neighbor thinks, it's too quiet there, and he goes to investigate. I won't tell you what he found, but you can imagine. This was on a rural road in Hants County, Nova Scotia. So do all the roads to hell lie through the city? Perhaps not.
Well, it's an interesting parallel, because the beauty of the Hells Angels is, if you think of where they're located in Quebec, right, there actually is not a chapter in Montreal. Mont Boucher had his headquarters just down the street south of the Olympic Stadium. But the Montreal chapter was actually not in the city of Montreal. They have chapters in Saint-Basile-le-Grand, Sorel, Trois-Rivières, Quebec City, even the Quebec City chapter, I've been to the chapter, was actually not in Quebec City. Again, it was in Saint-Nicolas, just on the other side of the bridge. There's a great story. I met the bus driver, neighbor. He had a handlebar mustache, and he, quiet neighborhood, and he wakes up when he lives in a bungalow in the outskirts of Quebec City, and he finds out, so a typical small Quebec town, right, Saint-Nicolas, and he wakes up one morning to find he literally has the neighbors from hell, right, because they're like building a clubhouse. So he goes over, and I've been to his house, so his fence, like, you know, goes right up to there. So he kind of leans over, and the bikers come out, you know, and of course they're talking in Joao, but he sort of says, you know, well, you can't do this. And he goes, well, are you going to stop us? And he says, well, I was here before you. And so he, it's a classic, and you should see his mustache. It's quite impressive. So he goes back to his house, and he kind of mutters. And over the while, these neighbors get worse and worse. At one point, there's a huge explosion, and a carcass of a Jeep, like, lands in his driveway. This was at the heights of the biker war. So this bus driver, along with the other citizens, organizes a kind of human chain where they circle the Hells Angels clubhouse to sort of say, we don't want you here. That chain didn't kick out the bikers, but they put enough pressure on the government. They eventually helped pass both the anti-gang law and the anti-bunker law, and eventually that clubhouse was shut down. He got rid of his neighbors from hell. So the Hells Angels implanted themselves in the smaller communities, in part because it's, you know, they're not stupid. Prices are cheaper. For security, you want to be able to have, if any of you have been to the Sorel Clubhouse, or they need a bunker style where they could survey. The Sherbrooke Clubhouse is on a kind of carved into a mountain where there's only one road to get to them. In Vancouver, they actually do have urban chapter clubhouses, but a lot of them are also in the smaller centers. So the Hells Angels were wise to try to move out to places where they could dominate quicker, where the police were going to be less equipped to deal with them. But they move in, and again, going to your business model, the Hells Angels were frustrated because they were big in Quebec, but they couldn't crack the Golden Horseshoe. There were no Hells Angels in southern Ontario, where, you know, at least half the population, and certainly most of the drug trade operates, up until 2000. And so the Hells Angels were frustrated, and they eventually did a corporate merger. And they took over a dozen gangs who had other names, and they bought them.
It
was a hostile takeover. And they instantly went from zero to becoming the biggest gang in southern Ontario. So a very classic business model, and a very, very wise one.
One thing that struck me is you were talking about these, their bunkers and their chapters, and when they were reined in and prosecuted, the chapter is shut down. If we go back to the internet problem, why are not more of these thousands of abusive sites shut down? You did talk about a model in the UK where that was being done, if not shut down, at least blocked.
The parallel between, I never really thought about it, but you're right, the parallel between the bikers, which is classic organized crime, and then the predators online, which is the virtual world, is quite striking in terms of a lot of the differences. One of the big differences is that the bikers actually are an organized group. The predators are not, by definition. They are individuals who actually do have a lot of coordination, but there's not one or two gangs, except for a couple of the businesses I mentioned before, like the Reedies out of Texas, where you take them down, you take down their whole business. But the predators tend to be individuals, tend to be anonymous. The Hells Angels, bless their heart, literally walk around with tattoos saying, I'm a Hells Angel, right? I'm a criminal, catch me, right? The predators boast about their activities and will post the pictures, but because they're hiding behind proxy servers and in encryption, they're much harder to find. So what the police do, they'll take out individual predators like that rocket scientist, right, who was arrested by Emily. Or they'll infiltrate some of these chat rooms. I tell the story of the Wickerman. There was a club, an online chat room, where in the end it was several dozen predators who lived in Canada, the UK, and the United States, who were trading pictures of children they were abusing, their own children. It actually started, and this is a, I think maybe leads very well into what we're talking about in terms of urban landscapes. Imagine you're at a ball hockey game. This took place in Edmonton. But you're at a game here in Montreal, and you overhear two young children. I think their time they were 5 and 7. And the girl and the boy are talking, and they sort of say, "Oh, well, you're not going to get, you know, you're not going to get candy tonight or this week." And she says, "Why not?" And says, "And excuse my my language, but she says something to the effect, well, you didn't suck daddy's pee-pee." So the woman who hears this turns and says, "Children, you know, don't talk like that." And they say, quite honestly and innocently, "But it's true." What do you do if you hear that? You know, as a children, just you don't necessarily know the children. What do you do? Well, this woman wrestled and wasn't sure what to do. She brings it up to some of the people at work. Most people said, "Ah, don't get involved. We don't know." She, in the end, decides to report the case. Child services investigate, and immediately, when they actually go to the house, the children disclose right away. Disclose means they say, "Yes, this is, you know, dad is abusing us," although they don't use the word abuse. The father, who's called Mark Langham in the book, I've met him, he's now serving time. When he drives up and he actually sees the police, he knows right away what it is. And he gives himself up, and he's kind of almost relieved. He'd been a pedophile for most of his life. And when he's in the holding tank, he decides, for whatever reason, he says, "You know what, there's going to be more children out there. I'm going to sort of turn in some of my fellow predators." So, you know, in an urban setting, one woman decides to sort of maybe do something from a community-minded spirit. This predator tells the police there's this secret chat room. He gives them the codes. And as I explain in the book, the policeman first kind of gets some of his buddies. He goes online, and he's starting chatting. He's now this predator. He's now Mark Langham. He's taken over his identity. He logs on to a man who he quickly realizes from the UK. And within seconds, the man is abusing a little girl in a nightgown who's walking past him in a nightgown on the webcam. The cop freezes and says, "Oh my God, this is live, this is real." He shuts down, but he gathers enough electronic information about this man to immediately send the information to London. And the cop in London is able to arrest this man and save the girl. The police now realize they have found a very important secret chat room. And over months and months of infiltrating this chat room, very similar to what we were talking about, how they do with the Hells Angels, they land up arresting more than 50 predators and rescuing more than 20 children. So they shut down that chat room. But unlike, well, to some degree similar to what happened in Quebec, close down 4 chapters, 3 others pop up. But at least it's a real physical address. The police know where they are. Mm-hmm. In the internet, it's, you know, they just create a new virtual world. In the UK, what they decided to do is the internet companies, because they're, I think, somewhat more socially conscious, and also because privacy issues are somewhat less of a concern in the UK, got together with the police and NGOs and set up something called the Internet Watch Foundation. And they said, "Well, we can't necessarily shut down all these sites, but we can certainly block, since we know what the address is for a lot of these sites, we can certainly block all the foreign sites." What they do is they canvass the web, they could see if the address is foreign, they could block it so that when you go on to www.abusekidsrightnow.russia or, you know, .com, if it's a foreign site, you will just be blocked. You won't be able to get to it because all the internet companies have decided to cooperate. The ones that are domestic, British, they pass on to the police, they get them shut down. They reduced the amount of child porn sites that were based in the UK from 40 to less than 1%, right? Mm. Just knocked them away. Where did they go? 28% of the sites are now based out of Russia, and 62% are based out of the United States. So,
but there don't seem to be dramatic court cases resulting from this, as there are in the case of biker gangs. Is it because these people, is it shame, resignation, they just give up, or they don't have the same level of legal sophistication
It's a combination. Well, it's a combination of factors. We don't see a lot of it in Canada because we don't see a lot of it overall because overwhelmingly it's in the high 90% people plead on these cases. They plead because of the shame and the embarrassment and because the evidence is so overwhelming. It's pictures found on your computer. or often pictures of yourself abusing, you know, if it's a hands-on abuse, you have the pictures. So it is photographic evidence of the highest quality. It goes back to that initial irony I was saying. This is the new face of crime in the 21st century, one of the hardest to find because it's all anonymous, but the beauty is that when you do catch the bad guy, there is tremendous proof because the guy was stupid enough that the very crime itself involves boasting and spreading proof of your crime. I tell the story in the book of a little girl named Anne in Indiana, kind of a troublemaker, bit of a liar. She's 9 years old, and she has the luck of having the best teacher in the school. The school is literally called Walt Disney Elementary School. The teacher is the most popular school teacher, and he's abusing her, and nobody believes her, except this one cop who believes her, and he says he would abuse me, and he would take pictures of me, and I would see the pictures on the back of the camera. Well, the policeman knew that meant it was a digital camera. He spent 18 months looking until he eventually found the proof on the internet, and the teacher was sentenced to 30 years. So he pled guilty. It did make news there because it was a big case, and it was a huge sentence. In Canada, we have paltry sentences. Most of the cases are pled out, and so you don't hear a lot about it. We did hear about that big case I told you about, the Edmonton and the chat room. I wrote a front page story for the Globe and Mail about it. It was covered widely in the national papers. But those are the exceptions. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book, is that this is a crime that few people are really willing to talk about and investigate.
Did you ever feel when you were investigating some of this material, you dealt with a lot of very sensitive material here, did you ever feel you had to censor yourself or be careful about what you could reveal? Did that affect your work?
Yes. In both cases, in the biker book and in this case, the police were nervous about revealing too much of their operational methods. I think you sort of win over their confidence. You withhold some things. In the end, I convinced them, I think in most cases, that the bad guys pretty much know what you're up to, and it's the public who doesn't know. I withheld some information on the biker investigations, obviously the names of some informants. In the Predator book, One Child at a Time, I was very conscious. First of all, as I stated at the beginning of the book, I never felt the need to look at any illicit images, one, because that would be re-victimizing the children, two, because it would be illegal. And the only pictures, the handful of pictures I saw at a police station in the presence of a police officer, or I would read the descriptions in court documents. We also changed the names of all the children, except in one or two cases where the children went public themselves. And in some cases, we actually changed some of the other identities in order, if their abusers were family, and we didn't want to identify the family. So yes, it's important to make important value and ethical decisions. But, you know, it's worth. Just this afternoon, some of you may have caught the Oprah show. There's a famous story of a girl named Masha who appears on the Oprah show. She was abused by her stepfather. The Toronto police had a big role to play in helping to find her. She goes on Oprah, eventually testifies, gets adopted, literally gets adopted by a woman, but gets adopted politically by John Kerry, goes to Congress and testifies against Congress. Her picture was on the front page of the Globe and Mail. And I just spoke to her this afternoon because her mother got a copy of the book and she quite liked it. So, you know, that makes it worth it, right? Here's this 13-year-old girl who's trying to put back her life, and on the phone she sounded like every other 13-year-old girl.
If you don't mind, I'd like to ask our audience now perhaps to join in the discussion. We have two microphones that I think we'll bring down, and so perhaps if you could just signal that you would like to ask a question, and I'll have my colleagues come down each of the aisles there with a microphone.
There's a couple here.
We'll start on the right, I guess, yes.
Well, that's better.
Going to be my hero for what you did with the Stephen Truscott. Could you give us the latest update, please?
Sure. A subject much closer to certainly the the generation in this audience than the internet. I was just speaking to Marlene today too, his wife. Stephen Truscott, for those of you who don't know, is Canada's most famous convicted murderer, 1959, hot June night in southern Ontario. He gives a ride to a 12-year-old classmate of his. He's 14 at the time, outside an airbase. It's 8 o'clock, it's about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. Kids are playing in the schoolyard. He comes back alone, saying, "I dropped her off at the highway." Plays baseball with everybody else. 2 days later, her body is found in the woods. He is charged after 24 hours of a police investigation for her murder. He is the last one seen with her. He is put on trial within 3 months in an adult court. He is sentenced to hang after a two-week trial. He sits on death row for 3 months. I got access to the cabinet documents. Diefenbaker was the cabinet, was the prime minister at the time, and they decided to commute his sentence, not because they thought there was anything wrong with the trial, but because it would look bad for Canada to hang a 14-year-old. So they sentenced him to life in prison. He spends the next 10 years in prison. He's given LSD, which was common at the time, to get prisoners to confess to their crimes. Unfortunately, Stephen wouldn't confess. But he kind of wins over the hearts and minds of the guards and the warden. He's actually allowed out of the prison, even though he's a convicted murderer. He kind of tends to the farm. And when I eventually wrote the book on Stephen Truscott and spoke at a church meeting with himself and his family, in the audience there were 300 people, including the guards who had guarded him, you know, as a child, and the cook from the prison. And that's the kind of guy Stephen was. What we investigated originally for the Fifth Estate and then in my book is we found, you know, just horrific examples of a miscarriage of justice. A little girl who was a witness, a key witness who bolstered Stephen's story, her statement was never given to the defense. They weren't required technically by law, but certainly ethically they were. An elderly couple who said they saw somebody hitchhiking at the time, that was Stephen's story of what happened to the girl, was never disclosed to the defense. And probably most importantly, the coroner who had written the definitive time of death to within 30 minutes and testified in court and said that based on stomach contents, the girl died between 7:15 and 7:45, which if true would not only be a scientific miracle that this doctor could actually time the emptying of her stomach to a 30-minute window, but as the prosecution said at the time, tightens like a vice over nobody else but Stephen Truscott, which is true. If he's right about the time of death, Stephen did it. It was largely on the basis of that testimony that Stephen was convicted. Well,
what I really find humiliating as a Canadian is that the Supreme Court is so,
exactly.
And I guess I'm enlarging the question now to those who are trusted and have positions
and
in power. I mean, if you look at sex tourism, some of the people who are convicted are judges and doctors. It's totally scandalous. The wise men in our society are not behaving as they should.
Absolutely.
So Alex's question, there's public outrage, but what does it take? I mean, Stephen Truscott is still
he's still well.
Guilty.
What's happening? You're right. And when the Supreme Court reheard his case, you know, only one brave judge, Emmett Hall, largely considered the father of Medicare, blasted the original trial for all the loopholes that I explained. But the other judges went along and said they found nothing wrong with it. What has changed because of the work of investigative journalists, because of the work of a more receptive public, because we're a lot more dubious now. Now we don't. I always tell the story. When Stephen Truscott went to jail, it was 1959. TV was black and white, but so was society, right? One of the most popular TV shows was a young Steve McQueen playing a bounty hunter, wanted dead or alive. And that actually was the headline the day the girl's body was found, right? Wanted dead or alive, right? Yeah. So our attitudes changed. Stephen is now, as a result of his wife's hard work, as a result of our work as investigative journalists, as a result of the work of his lawyers, we convinced former Justice Minister Erwin Kotler to review the case. Erwin decided in the end to name a judge. By the way, I should notice that those of you who don't know that, of course, I'm a Montrealer. Erwin's a Montrealer. Fred Kaufman, the judge who reviewed the case, is a Montrealer. But in the end, they finally sent it to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal held its hearing. It was widely covered, more so in the Toronto papers. The overall tenor of the proceeding showed the huge miscarriage of justice. It is now in the hands of four wise men and one wise woman who sit on the Ontario Court of Appeal, and we should find out in a few weeks, possibly, at most a couple of months, whether they will exonerate Stephen Truscott or not.
I was wondering, why is the Canadian legal system so lenient with regard to child pornography and predators compared to the types of sentences they get in the United States? I'm just curious, why is that?
Well, it's several reasons. Overall, we are a much, and I think we should be grateful, we are a much more lenient liberal society, and we try to deal with things in a more multivariate way. In the United States, there are a couple of cases, we talk about the case where people are literally been sentenced to 425 years. The man who abused the girl in the opening chapter of the book was sent away to 100 years, right? Those are sort of relatively meaningless sentences, and they may give some satisfaction to the people who were abused, but it doesn't really do anything for society. The problem is, even in the United States, and certainly in Canada, is severalfold. Judges, like most of us, have this myth that it is just pictures. You see, the man who comes to you, unlike the bikers, right, you know, who often dress up and get shaved and look quite neat, but you kind of know they're bikers, right? But the people who get convicted of child pornography possession cases are business people, church pastors, professors, completely clean records, you know? So the judge looks at them, and he has a handful of pictures. Oh, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I won't have, I clicked the wrong, you know, and they'll either get off or they get a suspended sentence. There's no understanding that, first of all, to download these pictures, you participated in a crime because a child had to be viciously abused. That 40%, if the rest statistics are accurate, of people who look at pictures are also hands-on abusers. Right? There's, you know, and that you're creating a market for the continuing abuse of these children. So there is no understanding. Thankfully, because of the pressure, we now have, for the first time in Canada, as I mentioned, you can't get away with house arrest. You will get a minimum of 14 days. It's not much. I tell the story in the book of a man who got arrested once and, you know, got a few months, got arrested again. This is it's not a disease, but it is a predilection for sexual preference for children. Once a pedophile, always a pedophile. You can decide not to act on your impulses, just as you can decide not to have a drink if you're an alcoholic, but you are going to be a pedophile for the rest of your life. And there's not that awareness, I think. It's a wonderful story a native judge told me where he sentenced a young man, it was a bail hearing, but he remembered the native legend. You know, when you take a picture of somebody, you take their soul. So he said, you have stolen the soul of this child and you should pay. I don't think enough judges see that.
Above, yes? Or here, sorry.
Hi. I've worked in with child abuse. Hi,
Margaret.
For some time, 37 years at the Children's, and was involved with getting mandatory reporting law passed, which obliges every citizen in Quebec to report abuse and neglect. That was in 75. And it was a prelude to having the Child Protection Services in 1979. So we were a little late compared to the other provinces, but eventually things got up and rolling. Last year, there were only 43% of the cases referred to child protection authorities were accepted for investigation and retained for services. Enormous number of children. My question, as I look at what's happening now, the speed with which the problems are occurring is so much faster than when we were just dealing with intrafamilial sexual abuse. And so we have to do something about the children, we have to do something about the parents, we have to do something about society and the predator. Do you have some ideas about, do you think just the criminal justice system is the answer? My sense is, with all the bureaucratization going on in terms of reorganizing health and social services, that we can't even give the families the support that they need to deal with these awful crimes.
But it's an excellent question, because as I try to tell in the book, I mean, the police are police, right? So they originally, they're trained to go after the bad guys. So when the internet wave kind of hit them, they said, oh my God, are all these like nasty guys going out there? Let's go arrest them. So, and they found that it actually wasn't that hard to find some of these nasty guys, right? So they went and arrested them. And then they said, and most police would say, that's the end of our job. But then they would look at their computers, they'd see all these hundreds of thousands of pictures, and they said, wait a minute, there are all these kids out there. We've got to try to find the kids now. So they realized that their job just began after the arrest. And then they started trying to find these kids and develop all these neat CSI techniques and blowing up the pictures and finding clues. And they're actually quite technologically sophisticated. And then it eventually dawned on them, as you pointed out, they said, we are never going to win this tech war because the predators do it 24/7. And, you know, after 2-3 years, you get promoted out of the unit. You know, we're just never going to win the war. The only way this war can be won is through making it a community issue. Right? The internet has become the world's largest playground. You don't shut down a neighborhood, you know, La Fontaine Park, because there's a whole bunch of rapes and muggings. You put up some lights. You increase police patrols. You get the budgets for police patrols, but you figure out some kind of neighborhood watch system. You warn the people in the community. You take back that park because it belongs to us. It doesn't belong to the predators. So those are the kinds of things we need. We need some technological fixes. I'll give you a simple answer. You go home tonight, and you find yourself in trouble on the internet, a predator, a pedophile, whatever, where would you go for help? All of you know to dial 911 if you're in trouble anywhere else. All of you know where your local police station is. Well, in the UK, they came up with the idea we should have like a 911 button, a little report abuse button on most of the browsers, especially the programs used by kids, so they could click and be instantly in touch with a policeman 24/7. Right? Simple idea. But we never thought of it. But what they mainly realized is they have to empower the children. We have to empower parents. I give a bunch of tips at the end of the book. There's tremendous education going on now in the UK, only starting now in Canada. Most of your kids aren't getting it yet because the schools aren't giving it to them, right? Where they're getting their sex education and maybe, you know, sexual disease education and whatnot. They're not getting basic street proofing on the internet. Don't reveal your information. Here's one statistic. One-third of the children, remember the statistics I gave, that two out of three of your grandchildren or your children have a personal profile on the web. One-third of 10 to 17-year-olds have posted their real name, telephone number, or home address on the internet. Right, so it, you know, unless we do this kind of basic stuff, but Margaret's question is most germane because here's the real frightening statistic: for all the things I'm trying to scare you about these predators who are lurking in the internet about to snatch your children, 70% of people who abuse children are known to the child, right? The high school coach, the teacher, and 45% are family. Right, so. The predators are us. The predators, you know, are your neighbors and your friends. They're not some strangers. So you're right. We need this much wider community involvement in order to protect the most defenseless in society. It goes back to that woman in Edmonton, right? If she didn't report to child services and if child services didn't act, that whole chat room would still be going on.
What was that with the sign? Yes.
Given what you said about the changing face of crime and the cyberspace reality of it, do you think that what has been quaintly referred to as red light districts in cities will continue to exist as actual physical entities, or will they cease to exist?
Well, I'm glad to say I'm not an expert in red light districts. I have seen a few, especially in Amsterdam and in other places. No, I think they'll continue to exist. It goes to what I was saying about just pictures, right? When it talks about sex crimes, I mean, the key element of sex crimes is you have to have some form of sex. The pictures allow... it's funny, eh? Only in Montreal could we be having a discussion about urban landscapes with the Thomas More and the Bibliothèque Nationale. We're talking about bikers and child porn, right? It's like, that's Montreal for you. But it's true. So the pictures allow the pedophiles or the child sex offenders to get some form of immediate release. The problem is it's not enough. They eventually need the actual physical temptation. So they have to find a child to abuse, one in their community, one in their home, or, you know, they'll, if worse comes to worse, they'll find a stranger. One of my next projects is looking at the child sex tourism, because as we protect our children more and our services get better and the laws get better and the judges get smarter, what do? They hop a plane to Thailand. They hop a plane to Cambodia. One of the experts I was talking to, he was walking on a beach. He was in Sri Lanka. It was, you know, there were like shacks along the beach and you know, no running water and just shabby living conditions and the living conditions. And there were kids who were giving out business cards with their web address on it. And there was an internet cafe, right, where they were chatting and trying to make money selling themselves on the internet. So I think there will always be these physical places where there will be abuse or illegal sexual activity. But what the internet will do, and I tell some of those stories, is they'll advertise. So you can go on the internet now, and you can plan your adult sex holiday if you want. But you can say, I'm interested in children under 12, Caucasian or Asian. You know, I'm interested in gay or I'm interested in straight sex. You will find out where to go, where the bars are, what the laws are, who to avoid, the name of the taxi driver. You know, so think of it as like Expedia for pedophiles. So that's where the internet will, in fact, I think, increase the number of kind of red light zones.
Julian, we've noticed a lot of breastfeeding in the United States lately about where were the investigative journalists before they went to war in Iraq. And that must be something that your website addresses. But my question to you is, I guess my first question, which you don't have to answer, is did you grow up as a little boy always wanting to be an investigative journalist? But my second question is, once you got to be one, how did you choose these areas in which you've become most interested?
When I was a boy, you know, I wanted to be a cop and I wanted to be a fireman and an astronaut, all those other things. But by the time I was in high school, where you actually begin to really think, what am I going to be when I grew up? I don't know what hit me, but I always knew I wanted to be a journalist. So I started working on the high school paper. My first interview was with Pierre Trudeau. I just sort of sent away, he had just become prime minister. He would have been prime minister in 68, right? That's right. So I would have been in third year high school. So I wrote away a letter to be interviewed, and I got an answer back. I'm sure it was all, you know, formatted and everything, but I later landed up being able to interview him for real. So I always knew I wanted to be a journalist, and then I went to McGill because they had a daily. I just worked for 5 years on the daily. I did manage to go to some classes and pulled off very fine marks, but I was only mainly interested in radical student politics and the McGill newspaper. And I started working at a wire service. It was the summer of the coup against Allende. I didn't cover it, but I was getting the latest news. In the old days, that was our internet. Remember the news wire? And you'd rip up the pieces of paper. So I always knew I wanted to be a journalist. I don't think I knew I wanted to be an investigative journalist. But after doing my first story ever when I got hired for CBC was on the Miron dump. And then I did a series on Quebec education and why our schools were failing. I realized I didn't want to do news. I wasn't interested in the mayor says this, the tax group says this. I wasn't interested in sort of giving the political sports scores. So I was always interested in investigating. And then very early on, just as my son was born, which would be 23 years ago, I wrote a book on the Ku Klux Klan. And so that began to interest me in sort of some of the, you know, the underpinnings. I think I'm certainly attracted to the dark side of society because I think that's where the stories are. I'm sure there's lots of people out there giving good news, and you could read pages and pages of the Gazette and other papers to find good news. That's fine. I'm not really that interested in good news. That's not true. I'm being facetious in that my books, in order to sell the books, I don't mean financially, but in order, no one's going to read 300 pages of absolute drudgery and sadness, right? So my books are full of horrible crimes, but then heroic stories of children who triumph and police who triumph and investigators who triumph. The Stephen Truscott story, right, is a horrific story of a boy whose life was stolen, but he triumphs in the end, regardless of whether we officially exonerate him. So it's in the bad news stories that you find these tremendous stories of heroism. But I don't deny that I also get a charge out of going to Baghdad. I mean, because it's the most dangerous place to be, and but that's where the world is pivoting right now. So I think as a journalist, you often want to be where the best story is.
A question in two parts, if I may.
Oh. Okay, up here first, and then we'll go over here. Olga, yes.
Yes, don't you think you're exaggerating the underworld in the city of Montreal? I mean, as far as the people here tonight are concerned, I'm sure we never have any contact with it. And it's sort of very, very isolated cases. So I don't think we really have to be scared about what's happening underfoot, if you like, on the social side.
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your question.
Don't you think you're exaggerating?
Oh, exaggerating
the underworld in the city of Montreal.
Oh no, not at all. You're right. The most of us will go through life never seeing a murder, never seeing a cocaine deal, and never having any direct contact that we know of organized crime. So in that sense, you're right. And you know, the reason I still live in Montreal, the reason most of us live in Montreal, it's a wonderful, safe city to live in. So is Toronto. In fact, so are most Canadian cities, right? That being said, there's a couple of just known facts, right? Organized crime is the main way drugs get into our city, right? How else do you bring, you know, the cocaine and any other, most other illegal drugs into the city? The illegal drug trade fuels not only the drug use by, you know, children, older people, and criminals, but people who take drugs are then often going to have to break into your house in order to feed their drug habit. So the problem with organized crime is most of you I've had my computer stolen from the back of my car. Most of you have had a break-in briefly, you know, something stolen. One of your children maybe was beaten up or stole, you know, got his wallet stolen. Did organized crime cause that? No. But organized crime feeds that whole drug culture and the criminality that leads to that, you know, street-by-street criminality. And the other thing is that, you know, most of us didn't realize until recently, the Port of Montreal was controlled by organized crime. Dominic Taddeo, who was serving as the head of the port, you know, would openly deny it, and we proved that he had people on his payroll who were known to be associates of organized crime. You couldn't move anything in and out of the port unless you had connections with organized crime, if you wanted to move illicit stuff. So I think, in fact, we tend to underestimate the influence of the... Absolutely. But because... and they will be as long as... You know, as long as organized crime doesn't want, you know, your business, or as long as organized crime doesn't want to kill a neighbor of yours who happens to be one of their enemies. So sure, Chicago was pretty safe in the 30s, you know. Doesn't mean that organized crime doesn't exist. That's the only point I'm trying to make. The internet is a perfectly safe thing for you to send your emails, but thousands of children are being abused on that internet. So do we ignore these problems because sort of we're okay in our neighborhood? You know, I think not.
A question in two parts.
Up here, yes.
Yeah. A question in two parts. First, the Port of Montreal and the airport are important ports of entry for drugs for all of North America. I want to know your information on the dollar, the Canadian dollar value of these drugs. My understanding is it's about $10 billion a year. If that, in fact, is the amount of money that comes through in the form of drugs, the second part of my question is, would you care to speculate to what extent there is local corruption that tolerates this enormous influx of drugs, not only officials of the Port of Montreal, officials of the airport, the police, the judicial system, local politicians. The list can be quite long.
You know, as a journalist, you're obviously always interested in sort of the biggest scandal that you can uncover. But I've also learned that it's actually usually the easiest solution rather than the more complicated solution. So if you think about it, to corrupt huge numbers of, say, top officials, politicians, the people who run the ports, the people who run the airports, is a very complicated, dangerous operation, right? It's much easier given the incompetence. So in the end, I actually realized that rather than corruption, more often than not, it's just straight-out incompetence that actually is at work. Here's what happens I'm quoting information from the Senate investigation into the ports of Montreal and the airports and all the airports in the country, right? Rather than to have to buy and pay for the guy who runs the airport or the guy who runs the ports, for you to get, you know, through the airport, you go through a tremendous amount of security check. At the airport workers are not screened in any intensive way when they get jobs. The port workers are not screened in any intensive way to get jobs. There is no basic background security check going on. So that the Senate committee, when it traveled across the country, found, you know, dozens, well, more than dozens, a high percentage of people working at the ports who had criminal backgrounds. Doesn't mean they're active criminals now, but it means they could be vulnerable, right? It found very little verification of people or their ties, and it found no members of Hell's Angels and their associates working in the ports and in the airports. So I don't think it's corruption. I think it's straight-out incompetence. It also has to do with business. The ports are in the business, because they were privatized, of moving stuff the fastest possible. They make their money by promising a company, you bring in your stuff into the port, we will get it out to the Midlands of Chicago within 24 or 48 or 72 hours. So the last thing they want is intensive screening and checking all the cargoes. All of you, I mean, I fly all the time, but most of you do too, right? You've seen, you know, I mean, when my dad would travel in his wheelchair, right, they'd have him, you know, get out of the wheelchair, they'd check my mother's bag, they'd check my bag, they'd check your toothpaste, right, in case you're smuggling cocaine. Those huge cartons, those huge cargo containers that are sitting outside on the port of Montreal, do you know what percentage of those are checked? 3%. Right? So every single person who goes on an airplane smuggling maybe a little bag of cocaine in your grandmother's purse is checked, but 97% of the cargo is not.
Because yeah, but your analysis is very how shall I say, kind. I mean,
well, it is because I haven't seen any evidence.
The fact that that level of employment is tolerated is a form of corruption. People could be screened if it's an important issue.
Yeah, I guess that I just
said. And the level of inspection can also be significantly higher. It's tolerated. It's tolerated. Both things are tolerated by certain people, by certain agencies.
But, you know, in the history, when they arrest the Hells Angels, and when they arrest them, they actually get access to their bank accounts. They get access to their internal emails. You know, historically, the Hells Angels did bribe a judge who was involved in a murder case in the southern United States. The Hells Angels did have people who work in the Ministry of Transport who were bribed to give them information on Michel Auger. But these were low-level people, right? I have not seen evidence, and there hasn't been evidence, of top, senior, high-level officials on a massive scale. I did expose, I was working for the Fifth Estate, the leader of the West End gang, the Irish gang that dominated most of the West End of Montreal, never got arrested in Montreal for all his years, a guy named Alan the Rock Weasel. He only got arrested when he moved to the United States. We investigated that, and we had questions of the top Mountie in charge of the drug squad, who was eventually promoted to become one of the senior Mounties in Ottawa, a man named Claude Savoie. And we had questions precisely on his meetings with Alan the Rock Weasel. And we put the questions to him, and we were investigating. And we were going to air Tuesday. It was a Tuesday night. And we'd released some of the information, and we were being interviewed by the media. And on Monday morning, I was being interviewed by the Gazette about the documentary. And they said, sorry, I have to pass you on to news, because Claude Savoie blew his brains out at RCMP headquarters. Because two police officers were coming to see him. The Mounties eventually investigated a year later, opened up his safety deposit box, and concluded that, yes, one of the senior Mounties had been corrupted by organized crime. So absolutely, that was a good case. I just don't think it's as widespread as we think.
There's a question here in the center.
Back to the internet and children. Have you, this is a dream, but have you thought of a systematic way of getting the data and your book into the educational system?
If you can give me a number, I'll send it. I don't know. I'm speaking at events like this. I've been invited to speak to a Superior Court judges in Manitoba. The police are putting it on their school agendas, the police colleges, so that's a good start. I'm speaking at a major event in London, which is sort of a new FBI that they've created in London just to protect children. At this law conference yesterday, there were a lot of psychologists and ministers, you know. I was approached to go speak in a smaller town in the interior of British Columbia. I would hope, especially the school system would, this is a book that could be read by older teenagers, and it should certainly be read by teachers. Going back to what Margaret said, I'll give you a good anecdote. It's not included in the book, but it was a school where the kids were asked to make paintings of themselves. And one girl, you know, they were all drawing pictures, you know, sun or whatnot, and her pictures were relatively normal. But every picture of herself had a frame around it. You know, it was her playing or whatever. It was a big, and when the teacher sort of said, how come, you know, and she says, well, that's the way Daddy always takes pictures of me. And so that teacher was sharp enough to sort of pick up on that and say, well, that seems a bit odd. And that, you know, eventually led to an investigation. Psychologists who are now trained to deal with child abuse. The kid comes in and seems a little sullen, maybe a bit bruised, and, oh, I fell down the stairs. And psychologists or front care child workers are now alerted to that. What they're not alerted to do, as one of the child care workers in the book says, is when that kid comes in and actually discloses and says, yes, you know, Daddy abuses me or whatever they say, they don't ask, was there a camera involved as well? See, because the kids will not disclose, they'll only disclose the minimum. And you have to know if there's a camera, because that leads to a whole level of abuse and the memorialization of that abuse. So I'd love to get the message out to as many young people.
One more question up here.
Yes, I just wondered if in the course of your investigations you have ever been threatened in any case, or have you been in any kind of danger?
Well, the joke I always use, my wife is sitting here in the front row with my son and my mother, is I'm usually not worried because I always get my wife to start the car in the morning. my wife is a journalist, writes a regular column for the Gazette, so she's both used to the joke and also used to the risks involved. There's actually, when I was editing the documentary on the Hells Angels we did for CBC, when Mom Boucher first got acquitted in his first murder trial, he eventually gets convicted, he sort of storms out as the new crime prince of the city, and he bursts through the doors, and he pushes everybody aside, the journalists, and the first woman who goes down is my wife, right, because she was sort of covering the trial, and you just see him pushing her down. Yes, there have been not direct threats. There was a story we include in our second book where they said after the first book came out, there were guns spinning on the tables in some Hells Angels meetings. I think I'm aware of the threats. I've had a couple of physical confrontations when I've tried to cover some meetings. But in the end, you kind of earn their grudging respect. When I was working on the second book, I was trying to arrange a meeting, and I eventually interviewed. There's a whole chapter in the second book about a California leader of the Hells Angels. And I said, I'd like to interview you, and here's, you know, I didn't say who I am. I gave him my name. I didn't sort of say, but I'm sure he was going to check me on the internet. He says, well, I'll have to check with the Canadian boys. And I said, well, that's it. He's like, not going to speak to me. And he called me back a little while later, and he said, yeah, they said you're a stubborn pain in the ass, but I could talk to you if you wanted to. So you sort of, I'm more afraid of the wannabes, you know, it's not the leaders, I'm afraid of some punk who just wants to impress the bosses and beat the crap out of a journalist. So I'm afraid of that. When I was in Russia, I'm afraid of organized crime. Baghdad, I was severely afraid of. militias and the mortars. But you take comfort in writing a book about the Hells Angels. The bus driver with the handlebar mustache, the waitress, Hélène Brunet, I was on a TV show with her. I mean, I'm afraid, but this is a woman who she's serving, coffee in some greasy spoon and hated serving these two guys because she knew they were bikers. And an assassin comes in, kills one of them, and is about to kill the other one. So he grabs her, Hélène, as a human shield. And so the assassin just shoots right through her in order to get to the bad guy. But Hélène survives and takes on the bikers and campaigns against them and sets up a victim's rights group. She teams up with the mother of that little boy who was killed, that 11-year-old, and another woman, and they call themselves Els Angels, right? you take courage from people like that. In Baghdad, I took courage from a doctor who was hiding out. He was trying to save people in the hospital for the victims of war until he had to quit because they were killing doctors. He knew of 100 doctors who had been killed. And so the hospitals aren't safe. The hospitals have become killing grounds. So you take comfort from the courage of those people. It sounds trite, but it's true. That's journalists are not half as brave as the people they tell the stories about.
I get accused in my family.
Sorry, so one more here, then two more there, and we'll conclude. So go ahead, please.
I always get accused by my family of wanting the last word, but it's not the last word, fortunately. I just wanted to give you a little ray of hope when you said, what are you doing about it in the education sector? 5 years ago, a group of us in the English community formed the Coalition of Education, Health, Social Work, and the Community, and it comprises people who are interested in children and adolescents from the Jewish General, Montreal Children's, the five English school boards on and off island, the McGill School of Education, Quebec Association of Teachers, and the Quebec Association of English Language Administrators. And we meet 5 to 6 times a year to try and understand what's happening in one sector so the other will get the benefit of it. Anyhow, to make a long story short, what we're trying to do is to get Mr. Scher to come to the Quebec Association of Teachers meeting in November. They don't know what they're up against because we absolutely want to have them on the program. B'nai B'rith has joined us and is interested in doing something about hate crimes on the internet. So we've joined forces with them, and what we thought, we would have him as a keynote speaker along with different workshops through the day on bullying, on child pornography, etc. So stay tuned, and hopefully it'll work and it'll be just interesting, because tonight's been a very, very interesting presentation.
Thank you very much. Is there a couple of questions here? Yes?
Well, I'm not sure that this is in the right genre, but what I seem to be reading about and hearing about are these gangs, and as you mentioned, the West End, and young people, 12, 10, 14, gangs, street gangs, they're young kids. Do you do any investigations, or is this something that just seems to be running rampant around the place and we never used to hear about it so much?
I haven't directly investigated street gangs except as it's connected to organized crime. I mean, it's something that's always been around. In Winnipeg, they have over 2,000 gangs, a lot of them affiliated with the Hells Angels and rival gangs. Here in Montreal, when the Hells Angels, and it's an oddity of organized crime, when the Hells Angels were taken down, at least several chapters, that actually allowed a bunch of newer street gangs to come in and rise into power. So yes, it's a growing problem, certainly in certain parts of the city. I think, to some degree, you live in the city that you choose, and then you choose how you want that city to be. And we in Montreal are blessed with a fairly vibrant community, fairly active community. Overall, we have not bad media, and I think it's up to people in the community to attend events like this, and then to clamor for change. It means not only better Montreal's police officers fighting street gangs, but programs and other issues so that you deal with the underlying causes of crime. It means Montreal is still woefully behind Toronto and other cities when it comes to internet crimes. We were way ahead because of the damages that the Hells Angels cost in terms of organized crime. Toronto and other cities have learned more about street gangs, and Montreal is a bit behind on that. So, you know, I think you have to try to learn about what's going on. I would just encourage everybody here to, it goes back to how we started this conversation. You know, not only, I don't think there was ever a bucolic period where we all lived in quiet villages and there was no crime and no child abuse, but there were simpler times. We now lived in a wired, connected community where the drugs that are popping up in Afghanistan will end up on your street corners, where the crimes and abuse of children that are going on around the world and in your neighbors are now available to you on your own computer that's in your den. So you are connected now, and we live in a connected world, and that means we're connected to crime. And it's important for you as citizens and for me as a journalist to try to be a little more awake of those dangers and not try to hide them and try to do something about them. And on that note, I can maybe say for, I won't, you know, you could, if you want just more information on any of the things we talked about, you could just go to my website, julianshare.com, and there's plenty of articles to read and pictures and ways to contact me.
Although, now, on behalf of everyone here, and especially for our thank you to our interviewers, but also, Julian, to you, for the genuine presentation you've made tonight. It's been very informative and provocative, and we thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex.